at 8:30 a.m. on Saturday Morning Coffee House on WERU 89.9 FM Blue Hill and now 99.9 FM in Bangor.
Support for WERU comes from Inner Tapestry, Maine's holistic journal, celebrating and supporting life, featuring alternative health and natural living articles, calendar listings, and a directory of resources available at health food stores and alternative health centers. 799-7995 or innertapestry.org. Support for WERU also comes from Quantum Insulators LLC in Belfast, serving Midcoast Maine as licensed dealers of the Isony Insulation Foam products, including renewable and recyclable insulation content. More information at 1-866-578-WARM or www.quantuminsulators.com.
It's coming up on 10 o'clock and you are tuned to WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill, 99.9 Bangor, and streaming online everywhere at weru.org. Common Ground Radio with your hosts from MOFCA is up next.
Good morning, I'm Russell Libby, Executive Director of the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association, and I'd like to welcome you to this month's edition of Common Ground, an hour on local food, local agriculture, fisheries, how it all fits together, and we're happy to have you here today. With me in the studio, Cheryl.
Good morning, this is Cheryl Wixon from Stonington, and I'm very excited to be here on this great day in August, and we're also joined by
Ron Poitras.
And amazingly enough, next Friday, the August 12th, will mark 40 years since the first big event that started MOFCA. So Ron's here because he wasn't maybe one of the first people in, but he was there pretty early on, and we're going to go back in time a little bit. First, just a kind of a quick look around the state, what's happening in the markets and what we're seeing out there, and Cheryl will start.
This is great. First of all, everybody is in full swing with blueberry harvest, and the rain that we've had for the last few days is having everybody breathe a little bit of a sigh of relief, so we should be harvesting Maine wild blueberries for a bit longer. I've seen some eggplant, and I'm very excited because I'm getting 40 pounds today, and sweet onions, cucumbers, great cucumber season. Tomatoes are starting to come in full swing. This is the best time to be eating here in Maine. So.
Well, I think our rule is that pretty much every time is the best time to be eating, isn't it?
Well, I like every time, yes.
Depends on what it is.
Those last apples in late April are sometimes a little bit on the
a little soft
marginal side,
yeah.
But we make do. In the event calendar, this is still the time of year when farmers are farming, but MOFCA is still doing a series of workshops targeted primarily to the 100 or so apprentices who are working on farms across the state right now. So this week, Cheryl's doing one that's, I believe,
yes,
sold out on food processing.
Yeah, we're doing a canning workshop over at the Common Ground in Unity for apprentices to learn how to put their food by for the winter. A very popular workshop. It usually sells out every year. So.
And next week, a how to process poultry workshop that is sold out, and a farm tour on Wednesday the 17th. At Tom Griffin's farm in Hope, looking at biodynamic farming practices. So if you're ever interested in or wanting to know about what's happening on the MOFCA event calendar, just go to www.mofca.org, and there's a full slate of programs. Obviously, the biggest one straight ahead is Common Ground Fair, always the third weekend after Labor Day, September 23, 24, 25 this year.
Yes, and that website's very helpful. The other thing that the Maine Organic Farmers does this time of year is we publish the pest report. Dr. Eric Seidman and I just got my pest report via email. You can also find this on the website. He did make a note that there has been one sighting of blight here in Maine, but he doesn't anticipate it to be a problem, but he does caution all of us farmers and gardeners to beware and to scout our fields regularly and to be good neighbors and to let people know.
And the one Cheryl's talking about is late blight, which is, you know, if you think about the Irish potato famine, it's the disease that brought down the Irish potato industry, and it's cyclical, and this is one of the years when it seems to be kind of starting to spread again. So there are cases in Long Island, in Vermont. There was an early one in Maine that's been taken care of, and there's another one in northern Maine. Basically, if you see diseases on, particularly on your potato leaves, that are suspicious, it's important to watch them and not ignore them. There's an early blight on your tomatoes where the bottom leaves fall, you know, get brown and fall off, and that's not a disease that is of concern. It's just ubiquitous in the soil. The other thing that MAFCA is doing that may be of some use to all of you is a weekly price report. So every week, every month, Melissa White Pillsbury puts together a report of prices at markets around the state. So if you're selling or if you're interested in buying, that's a resource that's also posted on our site. I just got back from a really fascinating meeting at the University of New Hampshire yesterday where the conversation was about can New England feed itself? And my quick and snide response to that is, I'm not sure, but I know Maine can, so we're not so worried. But the reality is we're all in this together. So what does it look like to have a vibrant food and farming system in New England, a vibrant fishery, something that actually can supply a significant part of the food that we're eating day to day? And in many ways, that feels like where we came in, because these are the same conversations that were happening in the 1970s. In some ways, they were kind of the spark for what MAFCA became. But in other ways, they seem even more urgent. There was a climate scientist from UNH, Cameron Wake, who spoke yesterday. And he looked basically at the various IPCC scenarios, and every one of them has summers drier, rainfall less spread out, more concentrated in big storms, higher temperatures. And when you look at those numbers, Maine is a place where a lot of people are going to want to grow food. So feels like we're on the right path, and yet we have to continually adjust and accommodate and find ways to make things happen. So I'm really pleased to welcome my old friend, Ron Poitras, old in terms of years that we've known each other.
Glad you added that, Russell.
Yeah. to the show today. Ron, and we'll go through this, was an early MAFCA member, supporter, organizer, and headed to the Hancock County Regional Planning Commission, where he spent a number of years and now has a small farm in Surrey, small potatoes farm. So welcome, Ron.
Thank you, Russ. Glad to be here.
So were you at that Thomas Point? We didn't rehearse this part, obviously. Were you at that Thomas Point meeting in August 71, Ron?
No, I wasn't. But I was engaged with MAFCA in the early years, in the early 70s. And that was when MAFCA had a strong network of regional chapters. And I think the statewide organization was more embryonic at that point. But we used to meet with the folks in your neighborhood, Russell, in Mount Vernon, Kathy and Charles, can't remember their last name.
Hudson,
yeah. Right. And that was always great because you kind of got a feel for what different people were doing and how we could all collaborate, work together. So that's how I got involved with MAFCA in the beginning.
And were you part of that Back to the Land movement coming from away, so to speak, or just got caught up in it like so many of us did?
No, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Mainer. I've only lived outside the state for 2 years, and that was under protest, really.
Lucky you.
So, no, I've always been here, and my father was a terrific gardener, and he hauled me out into his garden early on, so I started early trying to figure out how to do all this.
And was your father using organic practices or kind of on the edge of it? Or
he was kind of on the edge of it. I think he saw that in order to do this, you had to do it as inexpensively as possible. And at that point in time, it was using hen dressing from the neighbor next door. So that
very,
seemed
very
to work very well.
Practical and yeah. Frugal, weren't they?
Yeah. But I went to Rhode Island graduate school, and came back and got involved with the Back to the Land movement, having read, of course, as everybody probably has read, the Scott Nearing book, and was inspired to try to do something similar and started building a geodesic dome in Wayne, Maine, and growing our own food. And also, that's when my collaboration with Mofka began also.
And I had breakfast the other day with Shetanya York, who was Mofka's first executive director, and we were catching up on all the changes through the years. And he was talking about the early days of Mofka having an office. So if 1971 was our starting point, by 1975 or so, we were a little bit more organized. We had chapters organizing around the state, self-organizing, really. People just wanted to talk about how are we going to grow food? How do we make this happen? And there was a great upswelling at that time of people trying to figure out how to do this.
Right. When I was at the state planning office, we had an initiative called Maine New Ruralist, and we're looking at how people were making a living in rural Maine, and there were all kinds of people that were engaged in sort of a patchwork economy, where they were either potters or artists or farmers, and able to make a living by having enough other things outside, either a partner that worked at a more conventional job or something else. But that's how it kind of really was able to develop, with that sort of patchwork economy.
It sure feels that way this last week, or actually the last 5 years of the economy starting to pull away from stability for so many people. And I drive around the state a lot, and I'm really struck by how many more people have gardens now than they had a few years ago, and how much bigger their gardens are. And then you look at the unemployment numbers, 10% roughly formally unemployed, and another 10 or 20% not really employed the way they'd like to be. And gardening and growing food really can make a big difference in your lives.
Absolutely. That's when, during that time period in the early 70s, when we were looking at different ways of how can we stimulate more of this entrepreneurship that seemed to be exploding at that point in time. And by the way, Maine has one of the higher percentages of self-employed people in the country. And so that spirit is here for sure. But it was at that point in time that I met Chetanya York and Albie Barden. And they had been thinking along similar lines. And we kind of got together and wrote a grant proposal that surprisingly got funded. And that's when Mofka was able to get some funding to set up an office in Hollowell. And we also set up a little store. It was in the same building downstairs called Northeast Carry, which handled a lot of the homesteading kinds of goods. And we also got involved in alternative energy products and a lending library of all kinds of materials on how to grow food and how to take care of animals and how to set up your own solar hot water system. So it was great. It was a nice collaboration.
And one of the things that Mofka is trying to do right now is to capture some of that history. So we actually have a little short photo book with reminiscences coming out in the next couple of weeks, Fertile Ground, 40 Years of Mofka, that should be available week after next, kind of marking the 40 years. And as I was thumbing through the pages of that text and all the photos, I was struck by how committed and how long-term people have been. The early Mofka people are still involved and chugging away, and we also have this new generation that are building in many ways on what happened before.
Yeah, it's really heartening to see. I think Mofka has really pioneered a lot of different initiatives in organic farming and supporting organic farming and providing the information and the infrastructure. It really, I think, has led the pack. So it's wonderful to see it all continue to grow. When I first was engaged in it, it was more of a lifestyle kind of thing to do. Now I see it evolving into much more of a business planning and economic viability kind of focus, where people are really seriously into it and trying to make money at it and trying to make a go of it, rather than just not to negate the lifestyle aspect, because that's still important, and that's in fact what I'm engaged in right now. But I think it's expanded, it's become more mainstream, and I think that's significant.
You're listening to MAFCA's Common Ground, an hour on sustainable agriculture, food, and related topics. I'm Russell Luby, MAFCA's executive director. Our guest today is Ron Poitras from Small Potatoes Farm in Surrey, not Sedgwick, right?
Surrey, yes.
Yeah. And in a few minutes, we'll open up the line for calls, so you can call in with your general observations, comments. And you know, today, we'd especially enjoy calls from people who were part of MAFCA in the early days to tell your stories. When I had breakfast with Chaitanya the other day, the term he used for what you just described, Ron, was right livelihood. You know, if you do something that you love and you're involved in it, you have a chance to make the money to support you so you can do the things that you love. And it's if it all works out, it's great, and yet sometimes you need that support network. So
that's right. Early
on, you know, did you have the relationship with the university and extension, or did people feel like they were kind of carving it out themselves at that point?
Well, I think at that point it was kind of like we were carving it out ourselves. There were certainly some extension agents that were involved, and some university people that were sympathetic to what we were up to. But it was clearly viewed as somewhat fringe. You know, organic was in the same category as long hair, beads, and Birkenstocks.
I still have Birkenstocks on, so be careful there, Ron.
I still have mine, but not today. No, I think it clearly was viewed as an important set of values, new values that were being introduced, but certainly not mainstream.
Yeah, we talked recently with Charlie Gould, who was an extension agent for Androscoggin and Sagadahoc counties, and Charlie really provided the gathering place, I guess, for the early MAFCA folks. So there were lots of groups of people who were trying to find solutions and find their way to organic. And they kept coming to Charlie, and he kept saying, I don't know, why don't you talk to them? And I don't know, why don't you talk to them? So even though he didn't pretend to have the answers, he knew enough to find a way to connect people. And that's actually what led to this first gathering and ultimately to everything that's happened around the state. And I think that story is repeated over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's, of course, Frank Eggert, who did a great deal in the early days to advance MAFCA's agenda. So he certainly was a pioneer in the whole process.
Yeah, that's Frank and Barbara Eggert, who farmed on Verona Island. And Frank was one of the first academics to actually take organic seriously, and he did some of the pioneering organic research at Highmore Farm. So Frank was a Cornell-trained, very traditional researcher, and yet he saw something here and, you know, created his own small farm on Verona Island and was an early MAFCA president, and that gave us credibility that that really was critical to building the organization, just that university contact piece. So you've gardened in Wayne, you've gardened in Surrey.
And Orland.
And you know, what's your observation over the years? How have things changed in terms of the capacity of people to produce food?
I think you have to be quick on your feet to be able to make enough money to survive in local agriculture. But I think that's changing. Certainly a lot more markets out there that can be developed that didn't always exist in the past. And so that's heartening. And, I think at one point in Orland here, in fact, we had a small farm that was supplying local restaurants, and we were growing flowers, and, we were keeping things going, but it didn't pay the mortgage. It might have if we had been debt-free at that point in time. It's not an easy road to hoe, but it's certainly meaningful.
You mentioned a few minutes ago how exciting it is to see the next generation, and I'm struck by some of the really nice transitions that are happening in just on the Blue Hill Peninsula, where Paul Birdsall and his son's been farming and daughter have been farming with him for a while, but now his grandson Drew is kind of picking up the reins and working the horses and doing a lot of the field work with Paul. And over at King Hill Farm, where Dennis King and Joe Barrett farmed for an entire generation, they've made their transition to their former journey person, apprentices, and you know, it's really good to see these transitions happening, because it means that something solid is there that can last through the generations.
And then for me, I live here and I depend upon these folks for my food. It makes me feel, oh, these folks are younger than I am, so I'm always going to be able to eat well for the rest of my life.
I remember in the early days, Shelley Pingree was running the MOFCA apprenticeship program, and it was kind of a new initiative at that point, and placed a lot of people on different farms, and they kept coming back in one way or the other. Either they would continue to work for the farmer they'd been placed at, or they would find a way to start their own operation, or I think that kind of apprenticeship program, that kind of way to educate people by allowing them to participate and do something actual with their hands instead of just reading about it in the book, made a huge difference. I think that's why MOFCA has probably got one of the more active local foods communities in the state, in the States.
I was reading this morning, Andrew Marshall from MOFCA's, MOFCA's education director is in Kentucky at this national gathering of sustainable ag educators. And Wendell Berry was the keynote speaker last night. And Wendell was just talking about the value of hands-on learning. You know, how can you learn to farm unless you actually learn to farm? It's great to have the idea, but you really have to just out and get your hands dirty and work as long and hard as you can until you have a real understanding of what's happening in the soil.
I remember Wendell Berry came up to speak to the fair, I think at the fair, and he certainly spoke to a group of 50 or 100 MOFCA farmers in the probably late 70s, and you know, he was so inspiring. He's a wonderful hero of mine, for sure.
Great. Well, we'll keep chatting, but we're also ready to take your calls. So if you'd like to call in, stories about MOFCA in the early days, anything else that's on your mind about local food systems, 469-0500, or you can call the toll-free number 866-625-9378. Those numbers again, 469-0500 or 866-625-9378. You know, one non-agricultural piece that crossed my eyes this past week was a big study from the Pew Charitable Trust on the fishery side of it all, where we're dealing with the parallel issues. You know, the capacity, who's going to grow it, can we do it in an environmentally responsible way and still feed ourselves? And their numbers are that essentially, we're only getting 1/6 of the fish out of the Gulf of Maine that we could get if we could rebuild a healthy ecosystem there. Mm-hmm. And that would mean we'd actually be able to get fish fairly easily, mm-hmm. relatively easily anyway, compared to where we are.
Yeah, the same principles that worked with the local foods community, where you attempt to go direct to the market instead of going through a series of intermediaries, makes a lot of sense. The farmer or the fisherman can get a lot more money for his product. Same thing with a fisherman who's bringing his product in. If he can sell it directly, he's going to do it a whole lot better. He's going to have to can make a decent living without putting in as much effort and having so much technology. So I think it's a darn good thing to be looking at. It makes sense.
There's an interesting parallel with some of the marketing techniques. We see some of the local fishing people doing community-supported fishing, just like our farmers are doing community-supported agriculture, so that it allows the consumer to buy directly, again, from mm-hmm. the producer. We have a really great community-supported lobster share. I actually buy 2 shares from King Hill Farm of vegetables, and I take 1 share and I trade it with my lobster friend. So I get 80 lobsters every season and my vegetables, and he gets fresh vegetables. So it really works out to be a great...
Holy smokes. How do I sign up for that?
Find yourself a lobster fisherman,
right,
honey.
I guess so.
Oh, shoot. And you're listening to WERU, your community radio, and this is Common Ground. We're at 89.9 in Blue Hill and streaming on the web. And we're waiting for your calls if you'd like to join us and share a story with us. I love these. It's kind of like trips down memory lane, so to speak. But I think it's great to add for those of us that have not been associated with the organization for 40 years, and I won't say it's because we're too youthful, but it's nice to understand that this vibrant, growing organization, it's how it started and what those folks were thinking when they did that. Did you know it was going to be this big, Ron?
Well, I'll tell you, you just mentioned a few minutes ago that if you're doing the right thing, what you need comes to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's certainly illustrated by the fact that when the first Common Ground Fair was started, the weather forecast was for rain the entire weekend. This was the first time we had gotten all these people together. Everything looked good. And that Friday, all of a sudden, the skies cleared. It was a beautiful fall couple of days. It rained at night, but not during the day and everything. We had droves of people that showed up. It was a wonderful beginning to the fair.
Yeah, I was there the next day, so I got there on Saturday. We have a caller, so if you'd say your name and town and ask your question or comment. Thanks.
Hi. Yeah, my name is Judy. I'm from Idaho, and I have a question for you. I'm on the our ICDC, which is our Idaho Community Development Corporation board that we're trying to do affordable low-income housing out here, and we're going to be building a couple of houses. Hopefully starting in the fall, we got a grant from Maine State Housing to do that. And I went on your site the other day looking for, you know, we're looking for young families to come out and try to do some farming out here or fishing out here or whatever. We're down to 3 kids in our school, and we're pretty desperate to get some more families. And I didn't see anything on your site that would kind of gear me toward to come and farm in places and stuff. And I wondered if there's a way to connect us with you guys and, you know, look for some young families.
So for anybody who's looking in, and increasingly we're getting people who have been farming for a long time or have land and really would like somebody to use it, we have a website. We have the MAFCA.org website, but
right.
We also have MAFCA.net where you can post an opportunity. It's basically a setup so you can do your own classifieds and let people know of these opportunities.
Okay.
Also, Andrew Marshall, our education director, is our connector. So he connects young farmers who are looking for situations with possibilities. So both of those. And then Ron has an observation also.
Several years ago, I was involved with a similar initiative on Long Island Plantation. And they are also trying to preserve their school and keep the community going.
Right.
And the only way that they figured out they could do it was to provide some land to people that could be bought
right.
at a fairly reasonable price.
Right.
That's the only way you could get, you know, new families and new people out there to
try
different things.
We do have land out here that's for sale, but the thing is we have a couple of houses that are going to be rentals, and we like for a year just to see if they want to stay, and then we have a very affordable land available for them to buy. So, and we have places around where people will be able to, farm or at least use the land. We also have a new from the Institute who has done some managing of greenhouse and stuff. So, kind of thinking, that maybe he could be helpful with, if we can find, someone to live here. So, anyway.
Yeah.
Well,
thank you, Judy. I was recently out on Idaho, and I don't qualify as young anymore. Otherwise, I'd be calling you right after the show.
you could bring some foster kids out and.
I think this is a challenge that we're facing everywhere in the island communities, even more so. The census just released a report last week that said only 16% of the U.S. population lives in rural communities now. So that 16%, there's a natural pull to the more settled communities, and we need to find ways to make the rural communities so attractive that they want to stay. It sounds like what you're doing is completely on track in terms of building that. Access to affordable land and places to live, and you know, in a sense, the island presents a market opportunity because there's not a lot of food being grown up. Well, there's not a lot of agricultural production on the island right now.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for your information, and I will contact the make some contacts with those people and go on your site. So.
Great. Thank you. So we are taking calls on WERU Radio 469-0500, 1-866-625-9378. And Ron, you were starting to talk about the first Common Ground Fair, and that's how I got involved in MAFCA, with one of my college professors saying, you should really go to this thing. I had not the slightest idea what we were dealing with, and I had a little motor scooter and putted the 20 miles up the road to Litchfield and had a great experience, and obviously it changed and shaped my life. We actually have two callers, so we'll take the first call, and please say your name and town, and we'll go from there.
Hi, this is Greg from Hancock.
Welcome.
Thank you so much for the show, and I'd like to thank MAFCA for all the great work they've been doing over the last 40 years. I grew up in Bangor. I went away to school, and I came back in 1971. And I've been eating mostly organic food since then, trying to as best I could. And what food we grow organically. And I support MAFCA and its efforts. I support local food. I think it's really important to have a lot of small farmers producing varieties of food. And but I've noticed in this movement lately there's been talk of something called food independence, which is described as living totally off the local area and not having food from away. And I would just like to say that I just don't think that's a good attitude to have. I'm all for organic farming because it's good to the land. 90% of it is good to what it does for the land, and I think about 10% is the improvement in the food quality. But to try to eat just food from Maine, there are maybe individuals whose metabolisms can handle it, but I'll tell you, if you're raising children, you're going to see an increase in infant mortality if you try to just feed them on what you can get around or grow around here. And, you know, we live in a country, and we should take advantage of some of the benefits. And the problem with the food distribution system and growing system is not that we have to eat food from away, but that the food system has been industrialized and capitalized and commercialized, and we need more smaller farms instead of these big, huge things. And it doesn't matter so much where the food comes from as it does that there be more small farmers and more variety and diversity. And at the same time, we should support the local food producers. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it's a continuous conversation that everyone within MAFCA is having. And my favorite articulation of it is from Paul Volkhausen at Happy Town Farm in Orland, who talks about kind of using an 80-20 standard. You know, 80% from people you know, from your own farms, gardens, from people you know, people who are doing the things that you want to do close to home, and 20% traded and exchanged and purchased from people in other places, not just in the U.S., but around the world, who are doing the responsible thing, too. Trade is good if you're trading with people who are doing good things.
Right.
And trade is bad if people are being exploited at the other end so you can buy things inexpensively. But I saw Cheryl just kind of perk up when you talked about we can't eat nutritiously from Maine. And
I didn't say that. I said there are things you can't get. Not every metabolism is suited to the local stuff. Populations develop through mortality. They develop an adaptation to the local food. If I were to go live the way an Inuit lives in the wintertime off the meager vegetables, I believe I would die. The same is true to a certain extent for a place like Maine. It's there are things you can't grow here that improve your health, and we've developed a population of people who can't take certain deficiencies. Do you see what I mean?
I do, and I respect your point of view. The one nice thing that we can do is we can actually can get a nutritionally balanced diet, and I have developed actually a Maine food pyramid, and you can meet all the nutritional requirements, but you do have to do a little things called like food processing, like maybe canning tomatoes or freezing vegetables, because I'll tell you, eating root crops for 6 months does get to be a little, it doesn't always meet people's requirements and constitutions. But I really appreciate your call, and sometime I'd love to talk to you a little bit more about how you can eat that 80-20.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I'm just a little bit worried about the this philosophy taking over, because I don't think we need to be independent of everything else. You know, we can't hide our heads in Maine and let the rest of the world rot.
Great point.
Okay,
thank you
very much.
Thanks for your call.
And I think we have another caller on the line. So your name and your town and your comments.
Yeah, hi. My name's Matt, and I'm a commercial fisherman from Monhegan Island.
Welcome.
Thanks. I just wanted to clarify a few things for you. That going ground fishing and catching codfish and haddock and pollock in the Gulf of Maine, outside 3 miles, you're under federal restrictions. And it's become so onerous that it's almost impossible for small boats to go. You have to take an observer for 70% of your trips are observed. You have a dockside monitor that you have to call and arrange to make a landing with, who has to see the weights of the fish that you're catching. If you don't sell in the particular port, Port Clyde, where we come into, the dockside monitor has to go to Portland and make sure that the weights are correct on the fish. Very, very difficult. I started a small fish and chip shop on the island to be the ultimate end user of my own product about 15 years ago. And we can't even do it anymore. You know, we have to catch fish that can't be processed and washed on the boat in the water that it was living in. It has to come onto the shore and be processed in a HACCP-approved area. You can't, in order to buy your own fish, you have to get a special permit from National Marine Fisheries Service to catch and process your own fish. It's a very, very difficult operation. And the other thing that you can do on the other side of that is that if you only have state permits, you can fish inside 3 miles. But unfortunately, state fisheries are not very plentiful, so it's difficult to catch enough fish inside 3 miles to make a living.
Those are some really important points, because right now, fishermen have been operating under this HACCP. So just pulling out one of them, fishermen have been operating under this HACCP system for a long time, and there's a major federal push to get farmers operating under something very similar, and Mafka is right in the thick of talking about trying to make it scale appropriate. And I think what you're saying about the way the federal fisheries permits operate now, moving off the food safety to the permit system, is that it's really hard to make a living if you can't come up with a scale appropriate regulatory system to go with it.
That's exactly right. You said it perfectly.
And, here's a place where farmers and fishermen have something really in common, and Mafka is having conversations with Penobscot East and Port Clyde and Northwest Atlantic Marine Alliance, and trying to find ways that that farming and fishing groups can work together, to have a common voice on some of these issues.
Yeah, it's this nightmare of overregulation that's driving more and more people to vote for the Tea Party, unfortunately, but I think,
God, don't go there.
it's a good example of an excess of regulation that was started probably for very good reasons, but has kindly gone beyond the point where it's useful.
Yeah, completely haywire. They're appropriate, I suppose, for a larger boat fishing out of a bigger port. But my own belief is the same thing, that we ought to have. We've changed our management system from days at sea to quota, so every permit has a certain amount of quota on it. Somebody who has 10 or 15,000 pounds of quota should be completely exempt from the regulations that these other people do, and they should be encouraged to find niche markets and things where they can get more money for their product. That's what the nature of entrepreneurialism in coastal America should be about,
well, everywhere if we're going to find our way forward. And I'd love to try your fish and chips sometime if they're still making them.
Oh, we're right there. But I'm buying fish that's landed in Portland when I can get it, and filleted in Portland and then sent to Booth Bay and comes out on the boat. And when they can't get it there, it's haddock that's caught in Iceland, sent to China, processed, sent to Boston, and then comes up on a truck.
Yeah, I think that's a system that we can all say is probably not sustainable for the long term, just in terms of energy flows. All Nat, right. Thank you for making that call today.
Good to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Great. We have another caller on the line, and just as we're getting there, 469-0500 or 866-625-9378, and we welcome your calls. This is Common Ground, an hour of local foods and agriculture. So please tell us your name and your town and your ideas.
Yeah, this is Peter Hall, and I'm calling from Castine. And I have an interest in the prehistory of the sustainable local back-to-the-land agriculture movement. And everybody knows about the Nearings, and everybody knows about Elliot Coleman and the whole Cape Rosier crowd. But there's some interesting figures who I've stumbled upon who came up to the Burkesville area around the same time the Nearings did, people named Ed and Carolyn Robinson. And rather than taking a sort of radical left-wing approach to sustainable back-to-the-land agriculture, they took a kind of right-wing approach with something called the Have More Plan, and they wrote a book about it. And I was just wondering if you or any of your listeners knew anything about the Robinsons, because their book is very interesting, but I can't seem to find anything about them. They came from Connecticut. They did essentially backyard farming in suburban Connecticut, and then apparently took their ideas and practices up here and were around until the early 1960s. So if anybody knows anything about them, I'd sure be interested in hearing about it.
You know them?
I do know. I've seen those books and are still very useful. Clearly was something that developed as part of the Victory Garden movement after the war. And I think that kind of initiated a lot of that emphasis or a lot of that interest at that time. So, yeah, they're very interesting. The other thing that I read at that time, which was quite influential, was the started out as a long article in The New Yorker. It was called The Greening of America, by Charles Reich, and it described the value set that we were trying to replace at that point in time, and how institutions were being challenged, and a new spiritual awakening was part of the whole movement. And I think that that particular book sold a lot of copies and had a lot of influence.
But that was much later than the 1940s stuff.
Yes, it was. This was in the 70s, the Greening of America.
And if I remember correctly, Peter, the Robinsons ended up at a farm called Underhill in Brooksville.
Right.
And the family is still owning and living there. So I'm pretty sure that they would be open to a conversation. They've been MAFCA members for generations. Their son, who's in Boston, is connected with MAFCA. It's a really good and influential family. And in terms of influencing just the average person who has a garden, you know, the Have More Plan, after World War II, literally hundreds and thousands of people took that plan as how they were going to grow some food for themselves during the end of World War II, during the Victory Garden era, and then continuing onward. And it included, I'm looking at Cheryl, who's a rabbit grower, it included rabbits as kind of an important part of that whole cycle.
Well, that was a great call. Thank you very much.
I think that series of books reflected kind of an approach to making a living, which was that one way to do it is to increase your revenue stream, and the other way is to cut back in your expenses to the maximum extent that you can. And the Have More Plan really focused on how you can grow more of your own food and provide your own meats and via small animals and cut back considerably on what your expenditures are.
And the exciting thing was it was right at the onset of the home freezer, so they were the first ones to really think about how you could freeze food as well as can it. We have another call on the line, so your name, town, and fire away.
Hi, it's Cynthia from Gouldsboro.
Hi, Cynthia.
And I just wanted to talk a little bit about raising all your food that you eat. We've been here since 76, and we essentially have not bought a vegetable or a piece of meat or any fruit in all that time. And we're pretty healthy. And once in a while, if we have a party or somebody special is coming who, you know, doesn't understand the way we eat, we will buy something, but essentially nothing. We store all our food through the winter. We have 7 freezers and a big root cellar, and we eat like kings. And I just wanted to make that comment that I think you can eat pretty much all your food that's grown in the state of Maine.
There are a lot of people who get a long ways down that spectrum, and that's pretty impressive if you're not buying any fruits and vegetables.
No, we don't buy. I have a philosophical thing, and some people look at me and roll their eyes, but I just think that we can do that. You know, we can hang our laundry outside. We can do a lot of things that I think some people just don't understand that we can do it. And maybe they're afraid to try it. You know, in the middle of winter or Christmas time, we have magnificent meals here. I love to cook, and I don't feel like I'm missing anything.
Good points. Really, quality is so important in the food you raise yourself and you grow locally. It's fresh, and it's going to contain much more nutrients and a lot more that's good for you than stuff that's shipped many days or weeks across from somewhere else. There's also an initiative to, I think there is a strong correlation between BRICS level, which is an instrument that measures minerals in fruits and vegetables, and its equivalency to high nutrients, and high nutrient content of vegetables. So if you have high BRICS number, chances are you're going to have a fairly healthy and very good set of vegetables and fruit. So one way to make sure that you're getting what you need, nutrient-dense foods, is to take a BRICS refractometer, which is a very simple device, look at how it registers on that, and I think you can get a pretty good idea of how good it's going to be. It's your alternative to vitamins. Alternative to vitamins.
I think you probably have a pretty good idea, and I'll say, because Cynthia didn't, but Cynthia and Bill's Darthia Farm has done a superb job of turning out young farmers through the years, teaching them, mentoring them, supporting them, and helping them find places. So thank you for all that hard work.
Well, yeah, and it's been really a joy. And now we're hoping to transition, like the Birdsalls and the Kings. And we have a young couple here with a baby, and I hope they're going to stay for long term. And they're beginning to take over some of the management of the farm. So that's wonderful.
And that's how... This is how it's going to happen. It's a step at a time.
Yep.
Thanks so much for your call, Cynthia.
Okie dokie. Yep.
Be well.
Bye.
We have another caller on the line. Welcome.
Yes, good morning. I'd like to try to tie in a few things going all the way back since you started out looking at the history of MOFCA. And, you know, I'm going to use some labels. They're not derogatory. But a lot of people we called back to the landers started moving in everywhere, and they brought the new influence. A lot of them had college education and were reading things like Francis Moore LePay and all the way up to the Greening of America. And they started to dig in and try with their souls to recover a sense of belonging and to help the earth recover too. And that's built up over time. And MOFCA was started, and a lot of people traveled a lot of miles and did a lot of work for free, and still do. And it's gone through several stages, and now MOFCA's really big, and it's gone through sort of a yuppie stage, and a lot of the older people who managed to hold down the land and buy land are quite comfortable. And looking around to see how can they keep this alive in the face of people who need to grow specialty vegetables and get a lot of money because of the increase in the amount of money it takes to live. Now, there's a movement that is called food sustainability, which is trying to also hold back regulation that's prompted by the larger and soon-to-fail agricultural systems that box tiny producers in. And town by town, they're trying to get the towns to agree that the local producers can sell their food directly. And it's not going to be a question of altruism. It's going to be a question of choice. We are past peak oil, and we're going to need to train people, young people, old people, anybody who can work and who can learn how to treat the land properly and how to try to grow food. And with climate change, that's going to be quite a challenge. I think that MOFCA would be a long sigh of celebrating how beautiful it is and how it's managed to capture the wonderful things in life and turn them into, you know, the sweetness of life. Also, really should emphasize the hard work that it takes and the altruism it takes to try to keep this kind of movement going in the face of what we have in front of us. We do need young people. We need to not have WOOF be advertising that it's a vacation as well as a way to work on a farm. We need to have young people who really want to work and really want to learn. And I was in on it from the beginning, and so was my husband, in the beginning of other entities like Fedco Seeds and Cottigar Farms and all kinds of things were going on, little tiny things that help to bring the credibility to what is now MOFCA. But it's a whole new world now, and we really need to seek outside of the complacency that I see and feel and hear to reestablish and roots that are deeper and have a lot more strength behind them. We've lost our pesticide battles this year. We are losing land to people who can come in from the outside and buy large swaths and start lifting off the top of the reputation that's been made by the organic farmers, especially the greens growers. There's a lot of work to do besides celebrating how wonderful life is. And it doesn't have to be hard. It can be easy. But I don't think that the integration that was beginning to be established by the people that moved in and the people who lived here continued, because there's not so many young Mainers that are getting a chance to really go ahead and do this.
Well,
so that's my comment, and thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. And this is the tension. You know, how much can any one person or organization do at any time? And you know, I've been involved in MOFCA's. Well, you know, I went to the first fair, so I was still in college. Went to the fair, got the bug like so many other people, and that's 34 years later. But what strikes me is how important it is for all of us to keep pushing as far as we're able in another half step, but we also do need to celebrate from time to time. So we have several other callers on the line, and that will probably get us right to the end of the show. So two more calls online, and thank you for your calls this morning. And first one.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, this is Dick from Brewer.
Hi, Dick.
Look, I've been listening to this show, just happened to have it on with mixed feelings. I used to be a gardener, and I used to be a homeowner, and used to be a lot of things before the end of my second marriage. And but now I am raising two kids as a superannuated single parent on every entitlement program that is available. And unfortunately, you know, this whole discussion has absolutely no relevance to my life, and I'm thinking that probably doesn't do about the bottom one-third of the economically of the state's population. I'm wrong, but you know, I can't buy a tomato that's listed as organic when for a dollar a pound less or whatever I can buy a commercially grown potato that's designed to withstand a 5 mile an hour impact, which is I guess the industry standard. And I don't want to rain on your parade, but I would like to hear whatever you have for a comment about that.
Well, I think you are out on the front of the curve of where a lot of us are all going to be, and that's one reason that I'm really pleased that MAFCA has been the whole spectrum from farmers down to gardeners the whole way along, and anybody else who's interested. You know, our experience is two. One, that even a small garden can make a big dent if you have access to land. And my oldest daughter works with people in exactly your situation. And they've taken community gardens as one of their important strategies to help people have a little place where they can grow something. The other is, even if you're income limited, and in reality, most of the people who are listening to this show are in that class, there are some things where if you have the ability to scrape together the buying bulk one time, you can save money for a longer time. So grains and getting a bag of potatoes in the fall and carrots can really make a big difference. And organic and certified organic is important, but just as important as having the skills to grow your own food and to make things happen. So I really admire that you're taking on the grandkids at this stage of your life, and you know, any way that MAFCA can help is really to help on the gardening side. And we have one last caller on the line. Thank you, Dick, for calling in.
Hi, am I on?
Yes, hi.
Oh, hi, this is Nick from Waldoboro.
Hi, Nick.
I was listening to Gray there when he called in about, oh, we've got to keep getting food from all around the world here in Maine. And one thing to keep in mind is that oil supply and prices aren't getting any better. And so we have to keep that so far as transportation. And also that, as someone else that called in and said they're living pretty much off their own food here in Maine, that years ago, people pretty much survived off Maine food. So I think Gray was getting a little upset in the wrong direction there. There's a lot of things to think about in this.
To Gray's credit, I think he's just saying that it's really important for us to have diets that balance and that work for our bodies. And so much of the country has moved away from eating close to home that it takes a while to readjust. It doesn't happen in one step.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. If you get a lot of transplants, yeah.
Well,
okay. The main thing to keep in mind is that oil supply is going to go down. It is going down. We're relying more and more on less and less oil. And so when it comes to transportation costs and availability of getting food to Maine as well as any other place, that's something we need to consider as the years and decades go by.
Yeah, I completely appreciate that. And I think we're lucky because we've got this deep, dense network that's been building up for a long time. So you've been listening to Common Ground, an hour on food, agriculture, and related topics. A couple of fishery calls today.
Yeah. Our next show is going to be on September 2nd, and we're going to be talking about the Common Ground Fair.
And Ron Poitras, thank you for coming in today and talking about some of the early days of MAFCA. So we welcome your calls and input, and thank you for joining us today.
Support for WERU comes from Southwest Cycle, celebrating 30 years and counting of providing bicycle sales, service, and rentals to the Downey's community. Located